Good morning, my name is Keegan Rasko, and I'd like to welcome you to Life Downstream. Life Downstream is a radio show where I, a high school student, and my high school English teacher, Mr. Andrew Morgan, talk to interesting people from around the area about their life experiences and how those experiences allowed them to learn outside of a classroom. And with that, I'll pass it over to Mr. Morgan to introduce our guest for today.
We're here today with Phil Eero, a local math teacher at Astoria High School, father of three, former Coast Guard officer. Phil, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me, guys.
So before the show, we had a chance to touch base about some of these different kind of chapters of your life and roles that you've played. And we talked about this idea that came up, which I thought was really interesting, where you said it's important to fail. It's important that you fail because there's value in failing. And I was kind of wondering if, you know, as we talk, we can talk about these different things that you've kind of done in life. And it would be really interesting to hear, you know, how has that idea kind of permeated that, you know,
helped
chapter.
Me navigate to
Or what was a takeaway?
Here
what
is Phil Eero, perennial failure from Astoria High School.
I think this idea is really interesting to me because I know kids struggle with failure, right?
Oh,
kids,
adults struggle with failure.
Yeah, everybody
and
does,
so everyone
right?
does. Yeah.
But especially in our line of work, you know, it's really hard for somebody to not be successful at a class or
yes.
in schoolwork. But before we get to teaching and go there, let's talk Coast Guard. So tell us a little bit about how many years did you spend in Coast Guard? What did you do there?
I did 4 years at the Coast Guard Academy and got a degree in math. And then I went to Hawaii for 4 years. I won't belabor it too much. I did a lot of law enforcement and I drove ships and did buoy tenders. I was actually in Astoria for a short time. Wow, 25 years ago when the whole town was pretty much boarded up. I actually taught at the Coast Guard Academy as part of my service, and I think I finished in Key West before I ended up in the hospital, which I thought was a heart attack. And I was like, okay, it's time to leave the military and go back to teaching. So, yeah, 11 years total active duty.
Do you feel like, are there any like stories that come to mind when you're in the Coast Guard where this idea of like intense struggle, maybe failure was something that, you know, actually taught you something and showed you something valuable during that time?
I did a lot of law enforcement when I was young, and I've recently discovered I have PTSD from some of the things that I did. And, you know, you make life and death decisions. And when I was younger, the decisions that I made saved lives. When I was older, I made decisions that lost lives in the Coast Guard. And it was interesting to go back and reflect on it all. And like, they all felt like good decisions. And in hindsight, they were all legal and correct, and they were the correct decisions. But you go back and go, man, I wish I could do that one again. Or, wow, I put too much emphasis on this and not enough on that. And it's interesting to reflect back on it. So, yeah.
What was kind of the nature of some of the work that you were doing with the Coast Guard specifically?
When I was at sea out of Hawaii, we did a lot of work in the Philippine Sea, in the South Pacific. I ended up somehow specializing in Chinese migrant interdiction. So I was on Chinese mafia smuggling boats, smuggling 14-year-old girls into the U.S. for... it was just awful, the world's most awful human experiences. And so I've seen things that are difficult to still talk about. So I've seen, you know, victims of rape and assault. I've seen battery. I've seen a lot of those things. And one of the boats I was on sank while we were on board, like in the middle of a storm. So it was, you know, those were exciting days, and I don't miss those too much.
I wonder if, you know, when a lot of people think of the Coast Guard, if they kind of really realize the full scope of what the Coast Guard is tackling on, you know, open water. Like I think a lot of people probably have in mind like, rescuing boats in distress, you know?
Yep.
And yeah, when you think about all of the things that take place, you know, out on the sea,
I've seen stowaways, mutinies, smuggling, human trafficking, illegal fishing. But I've seen an interesting gambit of things in the short time that I was in the Coast Guard.
What was the thing that pulled you toward teaching from the Coast Guard? Did you feel like it was what you did, the teaching in the Coast Guard, that kind of said, hey, this is cool?
Well, I had terrible high school teachers, and my math teachers were terrible. My English teacher, I still love the guy. I chat with him almost every week. But then when I got to the academy, I was apparently really gifted at math, but had zero interest in it. And I just had these phenomenal math teachers when I was in college. Like, all of a sudden, like, oh, wow, this can be fun and exciting and challenging. And I decided my freshman year in college, undergraduate, like, I think I want to be a teacher at this school. And I set that goal at the age of 18 or 19. And my academic advisor was the math department head. And he's like, okay, this is the plan. You know, you're going to graduate. I want you to go to your school for 4 years. We'll send you to grad school and you can come back and teach. And I did exactly what he asked for. And I got to teach at the Coast Guard Academy, which is one of the greatest experiences of my life.
Wow. What, yeah, what about that was really stands out in terms of like a teaching environment compared to other ones? Like, how is that different than teaching at a high school or community college?
You get to really build character. You get to build leadership. And my mentors at the Academy were like, teaching is leadership. That's the math department motto. And it was awesome to be able to teach ethics classes at the Academy and ship driving. And, you know, we got to discuss integrity and responsibility and accountability on a daily basis. You can't talk about morals in an education setting, but you get to talk about ethics in an education setting. But at the Coast Guard Academy, they have their own set of morals and ethics. And it was really fun to help students not only learn math, but we'll work on some of those really important soft skills that I personally benefited me for years after.
So when you got into teaching kind of full-time post-Coast Guard, did you focus on high school level initially, or did you
I did. When I got out, because I taught at the Academy, and then I went, and then I just couldn't go to sea anymore because I was married to a Coastie and she wanted to drive ships and both of us couldn't because we had kids at that point. And I'm like, you know, I'll try doing a shore ops and sitting in the room with a cup of coffee. And I literally had the wall of screens that they have in the command center.
What was that like? Did that get old real fast?
Or it was more stressful than anything I did at sea. And I did some really stressful things at sea because you can't, it's like when you're in stress, if you act, you get to act on the stress. Like, and I think it's like our human nature. You're being chased by a saber-toothed tiger. You can run and flesh out that stress. But when you're in a room with nothing but a cup of coffee, the only thing you can do to relieve the stress is drink more coffee. And I assure you, it doesn't help. And I just spent, I felt like I spent 2 years answering phone calls nonstop, making choices that, you know, one day that good news on the news and the next day just really bad news on the news. And it just started to take a toll and I just couldn't get out there and do it anymore. And that's when I realized that it was time to get back into a classroom where I could do things and get involved and get more active.
Do you kind of look back on that chapter now and see that as like, this was in some way one of these like failing moments?
Epic
this
failure.
Was like, okay,
yes.
But that showed me that I don't want to do this. And, you know, there's like, there's these lessons in failure, you know?
So. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I wanted to be a career Coast Guard officer and then I changed paths from being at sea to being ashore and I failed. I was terrible at it. I just didn't thrive in that environment. I wasn't political enough. And I just realized it wasn't for me. And I had spent at that point 15 years of my life wearing a polyester blue suit. And I'm like, I don't want to do another 5 or 10. I'm done now. And I had to admit that it was time for something different and teaching made me happy. And so, yeah, it was a failure, but I think I use that as a tool. Like I have students who I had college students who were like, I need to change majors. Great. Change majors. I need to quit my job. Great. Quit your job. I'm in a bad relationship. Great. Quit the relationship. You know, I invested over a decade into a career path that I realized I didn't want to spend the next decade. And it's okay to go, that was a failure. Time to move on.
It's really interesting to me in seeing the different kind of themes that are emerging in these interviews with all sorts of different guests from all walks of life, because I feel like there's this kind of continuum of one single idea that keeps emerging, which is essentially like, have the courage to take the plunge and have the courage to like know when to quit something, know how to read a failure, you know? So you started teaching. Would you say that the first year was smooth as glass, or were there any struggles in that first like placement? Was it hard to kind of get into the groove?
It was smooth for me because I was teaching in a military academy where I had already been a student. So I knew the environment and I knew the norms and I had incredible, I mean, I was teaching with my former professors.
Oh, okay.
I got to call, you know, Dr. Wilson Joe, and it was really exciting for me. And these were my mentors. I had the guys whose ground I worshipped. So actually, no, and they were... I was at a school where every teacher was required to observe every other teacher. You were expected, including the master teachers. The master teachers would just, they would sit outside your classroom when you weren't even aware, and they would listen to you. And as soon as you dismissed the class, they would come in and close the door and give you feedback on a regular basis. I was mentored every year that I taught there. And I just got a little bit better every day. And I would make incredibly dumb mistakes. And I remember one day I whacked a student with a stack full of tests. And the next day the student came to me. He's like, you know, that was battery. And I'm like, oh my goodness, you're right. I struck you. That's a crime. That's wrong. And he's like, and he was really, really upset. And I'm like, you're right. That was wrong. It happened. Let's go. Let's go talk to my boss. Let's take the next step. Let's fix this. And I'm like, and it was one of those like, wow, note to self. And those are, you know, and I, the kids, this, that we went and we talked to my boss and we agreed like, okay, yep. With learning environment. I went from there. And to this day, I try not to strike students with testing. It's really, really hard. But
so you, from that school, did you move into a public high school space or what was the progression after that?
I know we're talking about failure. But then I went from the Coast Guard and I ended up teaching at the number one high school in the country.
Okay.
In Virginia. So I ended up getting a job teaching statistics at Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Tech. It's like this magnet school in this massive, really wealthy school district. And every middle school top star applies to go to this one public magnet school. Hmm. And, you know, I taught classes cohorted with George Mason in probability theory, like for kids who finished multivariate calculus before the end of senior year and needed more challenge and graduate level work. Wow. And it was exciting. And I think... And I got to teach kids who most of the time were exceptionally bright, and a lot of them really wanted to be there. And if they didn't want to be there, their parents wanted them to be there. Hmm. And that was an experience.
Were there any kind of aspects about that job placement where you felt like, okay, this is incredibly difficult and there's a steep learning curve?
Yes. Oh, my goodness.
As a teacher in a space like
that. I learned that teenagers are teenagers regardless of how gifted they are. They still make the same mistakes. They still have the same desires to be respected, and they want to challenge everything. And if they're brilliant or a knucklehead, they still carry the same parental baggage. A kid whose parents dropped them off in a BMW walks up with just as much baggage as a kid who walks with busted shoes every day. And I had those in both in my class. It's just a wealthier form of trauma. Wow. And you know, it's being former military. I remember the school often gave me the worst parents. I mean, they gave me the students with the worst parents because I faced the Chinese mafia. I think an entitled parent is not a problem anymore. Mm-hmm. And so that was my job oftentimes, to just put up with a parent that really, you know, if you've heard of helicopter parents, that parent that hovers and tries to bubble wrap their kid. Mm-hmm. And I was definitely trying to let that kid fail on their own without the parents saving them.
Could you talk a little bit about, you know, some of those conversations with kids where you're walking them through this moment of failure where they are failing and you're trying to kind of, I don't know, put a spin on this, or not a spin, but show them like, hey, this is actually a moment where something positive is happening. What do you need in those moments in order to make that go smoothly?
I guess you don't wait till the epic fail to have the conversation. You really celebrate all the little failures before then. And so when a student tries something and makes a mistake, point out how great the mistake is. Mm-hmm. When I'm teaching and I make a mistake, and I make mistakes every day, my brain is a hot mess of mental illness and anxiety and dyslexia and PTSD. So I regularly get my numbers wrong. I say the wrong word. And I celebrate it because people are thinking and challenging me. And so on a regular basis, I try to find moments when students screw up and make a math mistake or a logic mistake. And I say, can I please share this with everyone? And the student's like, yeah. Hey, gather around. You know, what did Johnny do wrong here? Mm. Oh, yeah, Johnny did this. Okay. And like two other kids will be like, oh, my God, I'm doing the same thing. And then thanks, Johnny. Thanks for letting us see that mistake. It's important to really kind of key in all those little ones, so that when Johnny really falls flat on his face, you can just be present for Johnny. Like, all right, man, you're right. This is terrible. This is really bad. You know, we all have bad days. Go home, take a breather. And then the next day, you know, because they're right there, they're failing. They're in the middle of failure. You don't want to get lectured while you're in the middle of it. But the next day, like, all right, how was that? Pretty bad, huh? All right, yeah. What happened? And we go and we kind of reevaluate the whole thing. We have a little debrief of it.
I think it's a really cool idea to, you know, we live in this super risk averse and mistake averse culture, and the idea of, well, just give voice to some of these things. Speak about your mistake. Talk about it. And that's a way to kind of defang it and demystify it and grow from it. And when you're saying this, you know, in an English class, I feel like the thing that's kind of most analogous for us with this is, like, after an essay, if students look at, or we're doing this thing now where we listen to essay feedback, if you're listening to recorded essay feedback and I'm pointing out something and you're jotting down kind of things that you struggled with, I found it really interesting to ask students to, if they feel comfortable, turn to a neighbor and tell them about something you want to try to do better on the next essay based on the feedback you just got. And I'm always amazed at how willing a lot of students are to kind of talk openly about that. And I wonder, I mean, Keegan, you can kind of speak to this, like, what is the, why is there something satisfying in that for students to do? You know, like, what do you think, why do kids find that something they actually want to talk about and share?
It's a good question. You know, I it's hard because I think a lot of kids want to express a creativity. They want to find, you know, the point where they could find better tools to express their feelings or whatever it is that they're doing. And I think at a certain point, all education gets to the same level of, I'm just expressing myself. You know, I'm expressing my beliefs, my opinions, my experiences, but in this class, I'm doing it through math. In this class, I'm doing it through English. In this class, I'm playing music to represent that part of myself. And I think showing a failure means that you have a kind of road sign on which way to go the next time, that you can see where you're at and move forward.
In your music, if you're off and one of your peers is like, hey, I'm hearing this, you need to go this direction or this direction, you value that because you want to sound better the next day. And I don't know, but I find that students do really well when they get feedback, critical feedback, not all positive, but from their peers. And it's more valuable than the teacher saying, that wasn't very good.
What about that student who's just refusing to accept it, refusing to acknowledge it?
It's a good question. Usually something else going on. That student is not allowed to be a failure elsewhere. And then you got to step back and go, okay, you know, how can we make this okay? How can we make it okay to be flawed? And I tell these stupid, I think of like Master Yoda in Star Wars. The guy's over 700 years old and he's so wise. The first couple hundred years of his life must have been a train wreck. I mean, he must have made so many mistakes those first two centuries to get to where he was at the end. And I just remind kids, like, hey, man, you're going to reflect on this. And then the great thing is you follow up. Like, you know, a couple months later, you go, hey, you got through that, right? You survived. What do you think now? Let's talk about it. Let's go back and talk about that train wreck of, oh, hey, you cheated on a test. Let's go back and visit that. What do you think now? Like, man, I'm really glad. I'm glad that happened. I'm glad I know about this. I'm glad I can get through this.
I'm thinking about, as you guys are talking, I'm thinking about just these two words, you know, failure and success. And I feel like, at least in the classroom, often we assume like, okay, when a student completes an assignment, it either is this or this. And I really like this idea of just like what Keegan said, if at a certain point you start to acknowledge all of this is to get to a certain end spot where, you know, you've thought more deeply about this, you've acquired this new skill, then it's not really fair to just categorize everything in terms of, well, you either failed or it was 100% a perfect success. You know, there's this kind of spectrum here. And I think, those two words are just so loaded. They're such buzzwords, you know, it's hard to kind of escape them.
I have dramatically changed how I've taught in the last 3 or 4 years. And the great thing, I think Keegan's been present for a lot of this shift in how I've been teaching. I was raised as a lecturer. I was in high school. I was lectured on there's a right way and everything else is wrong. And even in college, it was, okay, let's take some risks, but this is the right way. And I think Keegan, your freshman year, that's how we were teaching. Like, this is the right way. And I've been getting a lot of coaching from math coaches about, you know, that's not the most effective way. And I think just a shift in the last couple of years in Astoria, we were putting kids in groups and putting them on the board and having them work in groups. And we're encouraging the student who feels the weakest to grab the marker and do it and make the mistake, and encourage the students who get it to sit back and let them make the mistake and then kind of guide them to it and how that benefits everyone. And every student has benefited from that. The student who makes the mistake gets that feedback, and they feel courageous. They're allowed to take risks, because everything is about taking risks. Driving your car is a risk. Doing math is risky. It's scary. You could be wrong. And then those students who see the answer, they have to let that other kid fail for just long enough to see it and then push them forward. That's good for them too. That helps them in their own future failures. And I've seen Keegan's a senior. I've seen these students as freshmen be terrified of failure, and they're average, to be frank. By the time they're senior year, I've got, I think, 23 calculus kids. Class average is a 95%. Two kids have B's right now, and I'm pretty sure they're going to fix that. And they work on their own. They screw up. Their friends just call. They work on their own. They'll check their work. They'll ask for help. They fail regularly, and they celebrate it. And they've all discovered that the only way to get better is to fail and fix it. And they've seen their 80% average turn into an 85 and turn into this and turn into this. And they can tangibly see it. They look around the room, and they're like, this is not the math class I remember 3 years ago. And that's been like the aha moment for me. Like, the more chances we get to have kids fail and have other kids help them through that, everyone benefits. Keegan, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I've noticed that not only does the CPM program help kids, I mean, it raises the baseline for the success rate in math, but it also teaches kids to step outside of their shells.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of kids who come into a room, and if you have a strong leader, you can, you know, force a conversation that maybe they don't want to have about math, or you could, and it also allows people to connect on some other level, because usually if some kid comes into the class crying because they can't do math, there's something that's upsetting them on the outside. And I think it's important to establish an environment where that person feels like they can focus on just the math. And then once you focus and put all of your energy into something, you're going to succeed at it. And that's one of the things that I think the CPM curriculum does really well.
Yeah, and the CPM curriculum is the coach that the math department has hired. It's called College Prep Math. And I'm a career lecturer before this, and it's really all about collaborative learning and risk-taking.
I think I did not have classes like that in high school, and I totally had math classes that were in this kind of other model. And I think just from hearing, you know, how it sounds like the class is laid out, I could imagine some of the stuff is transferable, you know? To like the person that can get comfortable making these types of mistakes in a group, or the person who gets comfortable watching someone else make a mistake and pause and gives them the space, like, think about how much value there is on both sides of that. Like, the person who's watching and their group member makes mistakes, I just think, I don't know, that skill of being less reactionary, just being patient and, you know, responding to what someone else is kind of doing and saying, instead of just reacting, I think that that's a really helpful thing.
You know? Yeah, and I agree 100%. The first couple of years we've been teaching, as my math teachers and I, we were talking about content and like, how do we get the math right? And now we spend more energy talking about the soft skills of communication and collaboration and, you know, the things that matter. Even if they never touch math again, a student can walk out and be an effective college student, an effective coworker, an effective supervisor, an effective manager. And, you know, as a parent, an effective parent, like, you know, let your kid trip over and scrape his knee.
Well, so this is a good segue. This is a good segue into what I wanted to ask about too, in terms of, you know, you have three kids.
That I know of.
You have three kids. And I'm wondering, if you feel like this idea of failure, letting your kids fail, how has that kind of played out on the parental landscape for you? Like, what does that look like as a parent?
Well, my kids, they I don't even have to say it anymore. They're like, the only way to learn is to fail, Dad. Yes, we know. We know, Dad. The only way to learn is to fail. My ex-wife, my co-parent and I always called our parenting style benign neglect. I love you. Because I love you, I'm going to leave you alone to fix this. And it's something I think we both learned in the Coast Guard. Like you gotta struggle and fail and learn from it. So like I was joking with you before this that, you know, when my kids were babies, I would let them crawl up a couple of steps and I would let them tumble down, and it hurt to watch, but they never crawled all the way up the stairs and fell all the way down. I'm not afraid to have my kid grab a warm or hot coffee cup. I'm not enough to scald them, but enough to go, that's hot. That's dangerous. Mm-hmm. And to make mistakes, and you know, and obviously not the major mistakes. I'm gonna save them from the big ones. But my definition of majors mm-hmm. has changed. You know, just the other day, one of my kids was just unhappy with an interaction with a teacher, and there was part of me that just wanted to barge into that teacher, who's my coworker. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't like this and that, and I'm like, you know, there's got to be two sides of the story. All right, buddy, email your teacher, copy me, run with it. Mm-hmm. And he did, and the teacher fired back, and really, I think, did a good job of putting him in his place. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wow, you learned a lot, didn't you? We haven't had that part of the conversation. That's the wait a couple of days.
Yeah,
he's going to hear this on the radio and go, oh, we're going to still have to talk about that. I'm like, yeah.
It airs at 9 in the morning.
Yeah.
he'll be in school.
And I think that, you know, I love them. I trust them. I give them chances. Like, I taught my kids to ride a bike. Well, the first thing we practiced was crashing. Mm. I would just put them on the bike and push them over.
Yeah, I've tried to teach a couple of people how to snowboard, and it's really similar. Well, you got to teach them how to fall first.
You got to fall first.
And then you can teach them the turns and do all
that stuff.
You
have to learn to fail first before you can succeed. And, you know, teach them that falling over is not scary. Mm. And then I'll go forward a little bit and fall over, and then I'll push you.
And I like what you said about this idea of, like, sometimes the conversation where there's reflection, that's got to happen a day later or once time has passed. Mm-hmm. Because in the heat of the moment, like, you know, if the kid might not be in a position to absorb, you know, this kind of deeper thing, you know, so give space and then bring that up later.
Yeah. And you know, I learned all of this by screwing it up as a parent. I've yelled at my kid when they're crying, and it doesn't help. You know, I've had failed relationships where it's like, you know, in the heat of the moment is not a time to nitpick this or that. You got to pick your moments. And that's all wisdom from failing and reflecting. And so, yeah, I've screwed up. I mean, I've had many, many successes, but I've really focused on the failures, and man, I wish I could have done this, or wish I had gotten out of that situation sooner.
Yeah.
Sometimes the best success is giving up.
Cool. Well, Phil Ero, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us today. Is there anything that you want to kind of plug coming up in the next month or two? Any math related stuff, anything, I don't know, community members could keep their eyes peeled for?
You know, for all those parents out there, just hug your kids and tell them they're great. Stop checking the report cards every day. Just, you know, tell them how proud you are that they're trying. And if they're not trying, tell them how sad you are that they're not trying.
Yeah.
I feel like if we as parents focus on the process, not the results, we would get the results we wanted. And I think that Astoria teacher parents are really, truly incredible at this. There's a lot of parents that just get it. And I love it. I love it. But every now and then I'm like, oh man. Oh,
focus
Johnny.
Focus on the process.
Yeah. Focus on the process.
Yeah.
So
cool.
Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for coming in.
So this is the portion of the show where I offer my student perspective on our in-studio guest today. And one of the most obvious themes that I think was present throughout Mr. Ero's interview was the theme of failure, but not just failure, productive failure. We all can learn from our mistakes, and a failure to learn from our own failures is possibly the biggest mistake any of us can make. But mistakes can also happen in our interactions with our family, our friends, and our relationships. But it's important to remember that mistakes are just that, they're mistakes. And it's okay to make a mistake on that math test with your friend or with your girlfriend or boyfriend or significant other, as long as you learn from it, and as long as the same mistake doesn't continue to happen in the future. Mistakes are a catalyst for progress, and I think that that's the best thing we can pull from Mr. Ero's interview, and I think that's exactly what Mr. Ero wanted us to pull from his interview.